Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During a Q&A with reporters yesterday, President Trump called the NBC report that he had called for a major expansion of the U.S. nuclear arsenal fake news.
General Mattis put out a statement, or is putting out a statement, saying that that was fake news, that it was just mentioned that way. And it's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write. And people should look into it.
That followed an earlier tweet in which the president asked, with all of the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? Bad for country, exclamation point. We're talking about what the president means by fake news, a term, by the way, that he claims to have coined. Joining us by phone is the senior manager of the Accountability Journalism Program at the American Press Institute, Jane Elizabeth. She's a former editor and reporter at several U.S. newspapers, including The Washington Post. Jane Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also by phone, the managing editor of factcheck.org, Lori Robertson. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks for having me, too.
First of all, President Trump has threatened to pull NBC's broadcasting license over a story he said was false. He can't do that, right? That's not a thing. Lori?
A couple news organizations have written about this. News organizations don't have licenses. Now, the individual broadcasting stations do, but that's the license that covers all of their broadcasting, including their entertainment programming that they're doing as well, not necessarily their news operation.
And if somebody wanted to pull their license, what would be the the reasoning for it? Could they be just pulled?
I'm sorry, that's a good question that I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer. I don't know what the legal process would be for that.
Okay. His views sound a bit like the Fairness Doctrine that was designed to ensure broadcasters present as opposing viewpoints about public issues. And it's something I kind of grew up with. But Republican President Ronald Reagan's administration limited that in 1987, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Jane?
Yes. Yes. And, I think this is an interesting moment in history because here we are talking about some basic rights and practices that we have taken for granted for so long. And all of a sudden we're having to explain and you're having to explain to people, no, you can't take a license away from an entire network, that these things just can't be done. So, on the plus side, maybe it's a teachable moment. As Lori said, all the news organizations today are writing about how, no, you can't do this. The president misstated this and probably has a lot of people confused, and we have an opportunity to clear it up now.
Right. Let's talk about the term fake news in general. I'm trying to think where it actually came from. The president says he coined the term. Lori Robertson, how about at factcheck.org? Have you checked that out?
We haven't checked it. I mean, he certainly uses it a lot. And I'm not sure of the exact, first usage of fake news or origin of it. Jane may have some research into that. We've used the word fake many times over the years when we've debunked internet memes or viral messages and so forth that have been, not real, made up, doctored images or made up quotes, and we've used the term fake.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Jane, do you have any research into the exact first usage of fake news?
Well, the things that I've read, Merriam-Webster actually just the other day when Trump said that he had coined the term, they researched it, and I think they tweeted this out, that the first use of the term fake news was back in the 1800s. So I think basically the term has been around ever since mass communication began in any form. But I do believe that it has taken on another form now, and it is the definition is very unclear. And at API and some of the organizations that we're involved in, we spend a lot of time trying to define what fake news is and isn't.
It's a thing in terms of the internet, right? Now?
Yes. Yes, I would say it's more, the term fake news is more of an internet-based terminology now, but there's an organization called First Draft News that if anyone wants to look this up, they have a great chart on the definitions of fake news and the difference between fake news and misinformation and disinformation and just plain bad reporting. And fake news, when as we try to push this definition, it's basically news that has been made up out of whole cloth, and it's typically done for profit, for financial gain. So completely false.
For clicks.
Well, not necessarily for clicks that lead to advertising dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this is something new. This is something that could not have been done without Facebook, Google, Twitter, and the social media platforms that that offer advertising.
Lori Robertson, what's your sense about what the president means when he says something is fake news?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen him tweet and say this in other venues where he's calling reports fake news, that he reports that he disagrees with or doesn't like. So it's a much broader definition. And I'd agree with a lot of what Jane just said. There does seem to be this danger of fake news kind of meaning anything you want it to mean, because the definition has become so broad. And we operate by a similar definition to what Jane explained, where fake news is something that is completely made up and fabricated. And it's something we've been dealing with for years, but it used to not spread on Facebook and social media. And instead, it was these viral emails that you would see, or some people would call them chain emails, but the same type of thing where it was just a made-up story that was spreading. Now these stories are being spread much more quickly through social media, and they often look like news. You know, the emails that you used to receive didn't look like it came from a legitimate news organization, and some of these sites, when you look at these fake news sites, they don't look legitimate either. But some are getting more sophisticated and building something that looks like a masthead and trying to make the site look like it's a news organization, and using names for the website, you know, like Tribune or Dispatch or something that sounds like a news organization or a newspaper.
And by the way, it needs to be distinguished from something like The Onion, which is satire, but also sets itself up to look like some kind of legitimate. But we all know it's satire. Some fake news purveyors have said, well, it's just a form of, I'm just joking. I'm just joking around, and people should know that. Jane Elizabeth, what do we know about what people really understand when they see it on the internet?
Well, I think we are in a different situation today. You know, sometimes I don't even like to talk about, you know, the history of fake news and that it's been around since the 1800s, because then it sounds like, oh, you know, it's okay, it's been around forever, and we're all still here. I mean, what we're talking about today is completely different, and I would say more dangerous than any fake news situation that we've been in before, because of the mass communication. Excuse me, at the level that we have today, there's just there aren't any parallels here to any other point in history. And I think with social media, I mean, I always say this, we have given people these powerful tools with very little instruction. And that leads to people misunderstanding the content and the sources that they're seeing in front of them. There have been several studies about how much people share fake news and how much they consume it. What we don't know exactly through research is if they truly believe it. Are they sharing it because they think it's funny, or they want to support a view that they have, but they don't really believe it? That's one thing we don't know, but that's pretty scary in itself.
Yeah, I mean, and it's predicated, too, on a history among Americans. And I don't know if this extends around the country. And I remember back in the 80s when I was in journalism school, we had to go out and do a man on the street thing about, people's trust in media. And it was after the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from The Washington Post, Janet Cook, was outed as a complete fabricator. And I was surprised at how many people rated the newspaper on the level of, you know, the daily newspaper on the level of like a National Enquirer or a tabloid type thing, even back then.
Yeah. I trust in media has been a problem for a very long time. There are a few polls like Gallup that measure trust in media every year, and it has not looked good for a long time. And I think there's a bit of a failure on the part of media to address that. If we were any other corporation like Nike or yogurt corporation or something, they would have hired a fixer or a reputation manager to come in and address that problem, because that impacts your business. And that is not something that media organizations normally do, and maybe that would be a good idea.
But they do have ombudsmen and that sort of a thing, or at least they used to.
Yeah.
There's more and more they don't.
Right. The ombudsman in newsrooms across the country, as news staffs have shrunk, that is one of the first places that they look to cut, in my experience. And there actually are very few in the country now. And, you know, the ones who are left, it's a big job for them.
Lori Robertson, factcheck.org, this must be heyday for you guys.
Well, yes, we've been kind of busy. so we have no shortage of work to do. And, you know, our primary focus is on covering politicians and holding politicians accountable for what they say, fact-checking the claims that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this whole other effort in fact-checking bogus information that people are flagging on Facebook. We and other fact-checking organizations are part of an effort to debunk fake news stories, which are completely fabricated stories that are being spread through Facebook. Facebook users can now flag things that they suspect might be fake, and then we're able to see what's been flagged in a database. And if we write about one of those stories and say that it's false, we can indicate that. And if at least two of the fact-checking organizations find that something's false, people will start seeing a disputed flag on those stories in their Facebook feed.
Are there enough fact checkers out there?
Well, we always say that the more the merrier, and there's room for more fact checkers and more journalists in general. So I don't know. Interesting question. There's certainly more things to check than we have enough bodies here to do it. We'd love to have a bigger staff. Reiterate one thing that Jane said. We get asked about these stories. We can look at what's been flagged on Facebook, but we also get a lot of emails from readers asking us to look into stories that somebody emailed to them, or they saw on Facebook, or they saw on Twitter. And it's unclear from the feedback we get from readers how many people do believe some of these stories. We get the impression from some of the messages we get from readers that they want us to debunk something so that they can, tell somebody else who sent it to them that it's not true, or they strongly suspect it's not. You can tell in the question where they're saying, this doesn't sound right, but, can you tell me if this is true or not? And when we respond to them, they'll say, oh, well, thank you. I didn't think that sounded right, but I wanted to be sure. So at least in that anecdotal evidence, we know that, you know, people are skeptical of these things. They just don't always have time or the tools to look into them themselves.
Well, Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, and Jane Elizabeth, senior manager for the American Press Institute. Are they going to both stay with us and talk about maybe giving us some strategies for folks when you do have the time and you are curious about whether something is true? They can help you pursue that. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the issue of fake news, what it is, what it isn't. In February, President Trump let loose a litany of criticisms of the media at a Q&A with the press, during which he said that leaks from the White House to the media were real, but that the news was fake. A reporter asked him how the leaks could be real, but the news fake. Here's the president's response.
The reporting is fake.
And if I look, may ask, look, I just want to ask
Jim, you know what it is? Here's the thing. The public isn't, you know, they read newspapers, they see television, they watch. They don't know if it's true or false because they're not involved. I'm involved. I've been involved with this stuff all my life. But I'm involved. So I know when you're telling the truth or when you're not. I just see many, many untruthful things. And I'll tell you what else I see. I see tone. You know the word tone. The tone is such hatred.
Still with us by phone is a senior manager of the Accountability Journalism Program at the American Press Institute, Jane Elizabeth. Jane, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
Also the managing editor of factcheck.org, Lori Robertson. Lori, thanks again.
Thank you.
So neophytes, people who are just starting to pay attention to the news, maybe they're one of those people that has never voted before and voted for Donald Trump for president. They're starting to plug in. They're paying attention. And he says, hey, I know. What's your response to them, Jane Elizabeth, when it comes to journalism accountability?
Well, I was listening to that statement from Trump, and I do agree with one thing he said, and that is that he is involved, so he knows the truth, what's true and what's not true. There's a little bit of truth to that. If people are more involved with their local news organizations and, you know, take the time and bother to learn about how journalism works, they will have a better understanding of what is actually going on.
Lori Robertson, paying attention, what does that mean, paying more attention and being more plugged in?
Sure. Well, you know, I encourage people to consume a wide range of news sources. And, you know, I think a lot of what we've been talking about today shows that it media credibility has a problem, and it takes a long time to build that credibility. And you really build it through the work that you do every day. But another thing that we could do as journalists is explain the process more, because I think that the public doesn't always understand how we go about doing our job. You know, the question of why should people trust what's printed in the newspaper or on websites, kind of letting people into the process of how these stories are developed and produced could aid in that building the credibility in that regard.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fake news this hour. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Listeners, what do you do to suss out the truth? How do you check the facts when you read something on Facebook or you get a link on Twitter? What do you do to figure out what's real and what isn't? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Journalists talk about the idea of fairness, but fairness isn't always a 50-50 right down the middle. Jane Elizabeth, you know, for people who don't understand how journalism works, can you talk about that and what we mean by that?
Yes, I think that we have been having many more discussions about the meaning of fairness and false equivalency and things like that in journalism. And I will say, going back to your earlier question, that one thing that people should know about and probably don't is that the amount of work going on behind the scenes in the media industry today, there are more efforts to work with the public and get them to understand and answer their questions and engage with them than I have ever seen in all my years in journalism. There actually is an organization of international fact-checkers, and I would say people don't know that. It's the International Fact-Checkers Association Network, at the Poynter Institute in Florida. They're a very active group. They are certainly partly responsible for the great increase in the amount of fact-checking in media around the world. There are three times more fact-checking efforts, fact-checkers, in the world today than there were in the previous administration. So we also have a lot of news literacy efforts going on around the country that are more active than ever. And organizations like Lori's, like factcheck.org, are doing more and more to reach out to people with videos, instructional videos, and trying to get into more newsrooms to reach more people.
Yeah, Lori, tell us about that and about how factcheck.org has changed and evolved with the times.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. You know, when we first started in 2003, we were really focused on ads, and that was the way political messages were being received by most of the public, television ads. And that has changed for us. I guess everything has changed. So as political messaging started getting to voters, not just through ads, but through YouTube videos of stump speeches, which used to be something that, you know, we'd have to dig up somewhere, but now anybody can watch the candidates speaking anywhere in the country online, and Facebook postings and tweets from the candidates. So we've really changed the types of communication that we're fact-checking. We probably do less ads now than we do fact-checking of other forms of communication. So that's been very interesting for us. And then we've also tried to reach readers in other ways, such as through videos. You know, during debates, we get a lot of our traffic through tweets and people following the tweets that we're able to send out while the debates are going on. So, you know, as the political communication has evolved and changed, we've changed along with that.
Eric in South Vienna, Ohio, you're on the air. Hi, Eric.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
The question I had is, in this environment, we seem to have a lot of things that are put before us as news, which I think qualify as fake news. So I guess that's one of the things.
Give me an example of what you mean by that.
Well, stuff that would be Entertainment Tonight shows up on the news rather than actually.
Well, why do you call that fake news?
Because it to me, news is more of something to inform and educate. You know, on a regular basis, I can watch the news, and I basically just expect, what crazy stuff did Donald Trump do today? and it isn't necessarily news; it's just something crazy that's put out there.
But you say you just kind of call it fake news, but it's not really fake. It may be factually correct, right?
Right, and not just the facts. So in other words, something that's put before us as though it's news. In other words, it's presented. So it might be slanted one way or the other politically, but it's put before us as though it is something that we need to see to educate us. And I guess that's the thing that I've been wondering about with the news media, because we keep seeing these things. It may not be fake, but I think it's being called fake news. It certainly, in my opinion, is fake news because it's not news.
Huh. Okay, that's an interesting distinction. Jane Elizabeth?
Yeah, I do see what the caller is saying. There was a report the other day about the problem that people have distinguishing opinion from news and entertainment news, and really putting forth the idea that this problem is opening the door to a misunderstanding of what is fake and what is not. In the media industry, I probably should say this too, we don't really try to use the term fake news, because news itself is not fake. I mean, that's not part of the definition of news.
It's an oxymoron.
Yes, mm-hmm. And we would prefer to use misinformation, which kind of covers everything. But I do, in reference to the question, I do think that media organizations could do much better in labeling, in separating entertainment, gossip type of things from the actual news of the day, labeling opinion. Mm-hmm. Labeling commentary or satire, because we have this expectation that everyone understands this just because we have done it forever and ever. We understand it. And that is absolutely not true. So we have work to do in explaining how we operate.
Yeah, when I was an editorial writer, I was shocked at how many people didn't understand what the editorial pages were.
Exactly.
Why don't you have the guts to sign your name? They didn't understand what a newspaper editorial was. And that gets back to that lack of understanding in general about how a newspaper, a news operation works.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And I think that, you know, I will say that the members of the public also have some work to do in learning how to choose media sources and interpret media sources. I always say that people spend more time buying a car or choosing their beer at the local liquor store than they do choosing their media. They understand cars better than they understand media. And it would be great to see that same deliberation in choosing what you read and what you want as your best source of news.
You know, Lori Robertson, I mean, a lot of that goes back to the fact that nowadays, well, I guess it's always been that way, but we get our news from our friends, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's also, you know, I know people are busy in life, and you don't always have time to investigate everything that's coming at you. But a lot of times we find that people don't read beyond the headline.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the bogus, fabricated, or, you know, sometimes they claim to be satirical stories floating around the internet that we get asked about, you know, if you did read beyond the headline, it becomes very obvious through either the attempts at jokes that the story is making or other clues in the story, you know, make it very clear that, oh, this is made up, and oh, maybe this is supposed to be some kind of joke. And that is not always apparent just from that headline alone.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. Heather in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Heather.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say a few things. I don't think Trump has always been involved. I know he might be a little bit now, although how much is debatable. And I would never get my news from Facebook or Twitter. I'm shocked that even anyone would even consider that, to be honest with you. And I think that Trump is basically a cult leader. I mean, anyone that's constantly saying, believe me, really shouldn't be believed. And he's he's really not with it. I honestly think he's an idiot. And I would maybe check Wikipedia or go online, double-check things, triple-check them if you're really not sure. Mm. but Facebook is not a news outlet. Neither is Twitter.
Heather, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk about, in the remaining few minutes, Lori Robertson, you know, as managing editor of factcheck.org, what do you recommend people do to check their to check on news?
Okay, sure. And, you know, I would say just one thing from the last caller on Facebook. I mean, you can follow the New York Times and the Washington Post and your local news station mm-hmm. and all kinds of perfectly legitimate news organizations on Facebook whose posts then show up on your feed. So, you know,
right.
you can use Facebook as a way to get news. But then, of course, you're going to see your friends posting or in other ways showing up in your feed a news source you've never heard of before. So, I mean, if you can spend just a couple minutes checking that out, it could be very beneficial to you. Like I said, reading beyond the headline, sometimes there are telltale clues right away that, oh, this isn't really legitimate.
Like lots of exclamation points?
Oh, that would definitely be one. Large red capital letters or something that don't appear in normal news stories. You know, checking the source on these things, a lot of the sites that we write about, if you go to their About Us page, they're very upfront with saying we make stuff up and you should not believe the things we post on our website. It's really that honest in saying this stuff isn't true. But, you know, people aren't checking the About Us page. And you can check the author. Sometimes you can see
if
that
there
it's
is
like
an
a,
author. Sometimes
if
that's
there is
a clue.
An author, or sometimes there's a one word name, mm-hmm. Or just a very strange, or all of the stories on the homepage of the website are written by the same person. Stuff like that. And also, you can fact check the stories. You know, we'll see a lot of bogus stories claiming Trump or Obama signed an executive order, and they'll even give, you know, oh, the executive order number, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you can look up the executive orders fairly easily and see whether or not this was, you know, actually an executive order or one that this website made up in this story. So those are just a couple of the ways that people can kind of check out something that's coming to them from an unfamiliar source.
And Jean Elizabeth?
You know, one thing that we really recommend is for people to sort of take things into their own hands and check data. And we live in a time where data is more accessible than it ever has been before. And you can really do your own fact-checking by using those numbers. Of course, the trick is what's the good data and what's the bad data.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that that ends in a .gov, .gov, or a .edu, research and statistics from those sites are usually very reliable. If they're sites that don't sound right to you, you've never heard of, I would probably stay away from them. The other group that I think has really stepped up in at this time when of misinformation are the libraries and library associations. And we have done some work with the Library Association, and they've been putting workshops on around the country. Everybody has a library in their community, right? So they're doing, you know, workshops after dinner on how to find fake news, how to identify it, and how to fact check your own news. And I would say that if you're a member of a local organization, a civic group like the League of Women Voters or the Kiwanis Club, to work with them and get them to work with a local news organization and put on some of those community events. I think they're very helpful. And from what I hear, they're almost always standing room only. So they're very popular.
Jean Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Jean Elizabeth is the senior manager of the Accountability Journalism Program at the American Press Institute. And Lori Robertson, thanks to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Lori Robertson is the managing editor of FactCheck.org. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, we're going to hear from somebody who once represented NPR. He was the ombudsman for NPR, and talk about his experiences. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump has cast the media as a one-sided opposition party that feed their own agenda and deliver fake news. His views about the media are shared by much of the public. According to the 2016 Gallup poll, Americans trust and confidence in the mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly fell to 32%. That's the lowest in Gallup polling history. One approach news organizations have taken in the past to combat the fake news charge and broaden the public's trust is the hiring of a public editor or ombudsman. They act as an independent arbiter between the listeners or readers and the creators of the news content, often holding reporters and editors accountable. But as we mentioned in the last segment, many news organizations are laying off their public editors. Jeffrey Dvorkin is the director of the journalism program at the University of Toronto. He was the former vice president of news and information at NPR in Washington and was NPR's first ombudsman from 1997 to 2000. He joins us by phone from London, England. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
A lot of people don't even know that ombudsmen and public editors ever even existed, right?
That's right. They used to be a position of more prominence maybe 10, 15 years ago. But as the economy has changed for news organizations, a number of them have decided to dispense with the ombudsman, thinking for some reason that the internet could act as that kind of keeping the news organization on its traditions and on its values. And that, in my opinion, just hasn't worked.
Right, because that's the pot calling the kettle black as far as how people are getting their information anyway.
Exactly. And I think that one of the issues that we're all trying to come to terms with, whether we're in journalism or whether we're educators or whether we're citizens, is to figure out that tsunami of information that sweeps over us on a daily, even hourly basis might be something that needs some kind of help to figure it out. And when the ombudsman movement in the United States was in a healthier state than it is now, that's exactly what happened. The Organization of News Ombudsmen did a study that showed that newspapers with a public editor or an ombudsman were much more trusted than newspapers that didn't have one. And I think that issue of trust and confidence and accountability in our news organizations is something that is even more vital now in a digital age.
The fact is that every once in a while and often enough, there's a bad apple out there, and they do tend to taint the entire barrel. We find it particularly with columnists.
Yes. Well, and this is actually one of the interesting issues that, as a teacher, I'm grappling with now. I'm in the process of pulling together a way in which we can impart news literacy to not just our students, but to the public at large. And this is helping everybody understand that reliable journalism is based on really three factors. Verification: is the information reliable? Independence: is the information that you're getting coming from a source that is independent of faction and accountability? How does a news organization acknowledge whenever it does something that needs to be corrected? So that those three factors, VIA, VIA, mm-hmm. Which is really created by the journalism school at Stony Brook University in New York on Long Island, they've come up with a fantastic system of helping their students understand and to become more news literate. And so I'm in the process of trying to develop that for my students as well, because I think it's really valuable. If we can do this for our students and for our public, our democracy will be better served.
My guest is Jeffrey Dvorkin. He was NPR's first ombudsman from 1997 to 2006. He's now director of the journalism program at the University of Toronto. If you have a question or comment for him about this fake news issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The New York Times just let go its public editor position earlier this year, and we already know what your opinion of that is. And the New York Times instead created a reader center to respond directly to reader suggestions and questions. What is that reader center like? What do you know, and what do you think of it?
I haven't seen it enough to know whether it's effective or not, but I think news organizations have to distinguish between public relations and true accountability. And I think a lot of news organizations, I'm not faulting the New York Times for this. I understand the economic circumstances that they and others find themselves in. I think one of the issues that media organizations are struggling with now is the issue of reputation. And so that at a time of diminishing financial resources and a kind of an insecure circulation or ratings base, a lot of effort is being made to make sure that the reputation of the organization doesn't suffer. And one of the ways that some media managers think it might not suffer is if they elide and kind of gloss over any possible sense of difficulty that the public might have with their journalism. So I think that that's not the best way to proceed, but I understand the reasons why they're doing it.
It's not new, this distrust. I mentioned earlier in the program my journalism school man on the street assignment to go out and talk about this very issue, and in the 80s, and was shocked. You know, I really had no idea that people didn't trust the media. It's not new.
That's right. And a certain skepticism is always healthy. The problem is now that all large organizations are coming under a level of suspicion, the likes of which we really haven't seen before. Some of this is being deliberately promoted by certain interest groups that want you to distrust all journalism. So that if you distrust all journalism, then it might be easier to slip in some ideas or some ideologies that will go through a less rigorous form of reality testing. But I think that that becomes part of the issue in a digital environment, is that we're all our own editors. We all become our own journalists. We all become our own whatever, because the digital culture, which has many fine attributes to it, is also something that has undermined the traditional ways in which we have had relations with important institutions in our culture, whether it's universities or our churches or our media.
Let's take the NBC case this week, where they reported that the president had called in a meeting with military leaders, had called for expanding the nuclear arsenal. He says, hey, I was there. That's fake. It didn't happen. These are sourced through unidentified sources. That happens more and more and more these days, unlike when I first started out in the business. What should people make of that? And should the media not be reporting on stuff if they can't name the source?
I think that that's become increasingly an issue for journalism. The use of unidentified sources actually forces people to say, well, if they're not going to tell us who they've talked to, why should we believe anything they say?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this becomes something that forces news organizations to take another look at it. If you're going to report something from an unverified source, there has to be a really good reason why that source doesn't want to be verified or doesn't want to be identified. And I think it's up to the journalists to find other ways of reporting it so that the sources can be named. It's incredibly disingenuous. It's almost deceitful to say to the public, listen, I'm a journalist, trust me. Now, in the case of NBC and Donald Trump and the increase of the nuclear weaponry,
mm-hmm.
There might be a way of doing that. The problem also is compounded by the fact that the competitive nature of news organizations now means that you may not have enough time to get that source on the record or to find another source willing to go on the record. That was the thing that was so amazing about Senator Corker, is that he was able to say, no, this is what I believe, and you can quote me, you can tape me, and you can run the recording of what I say. That, to me, is a really important breakthrough in how we and all media are reporting the stories these days.
Some people say that the problem is that journalists have allowed too much of their personalities to creep into their work, too much of their, you know, they're laying out the facts, but they're maybe in broadcast, they're saying it in a certain way, or in
yeah.
print, they're adding a few extra, a superlative, saying only and when just the fact would do.
I think we have crossed a certain divide in the election of President Trump, that there was so much non-information, misinformation, and disinformation in the last election that truth squatting what the politicians were saying has changed the dynamic of how journalism reports politics. In the past, journalism could be criticized for being too stenographic.
Mm-hmm.
Just here's a mirror, Mr. and Ms. Audience. You can have a look. You make up your own mind. But the flow of bad information became so evident in the last election that it became impossible to sit there and say, well, if we report what somebody says and we don't truth squat it, then maybe we're being an enabler of that politician. So journalism has taken a step towards being much more about calling people to account. Maybe they should have been doing more of this before, but now it's become so prominent that in a post-Trump era, which one day we will eventually be in, I presume, it'll be very difficult to go back to the old, more neutral way of doing journalism. And that may not be such a bad thing, but it will change the nature of how journalism is done and how journalism is perceived.
And it also means that journalists have to own that. If that's what they're doing, they have to own it.
That's why they have to identify their sources.
Right.
The credibility of the media, and journalists in particular, can't be based just on the fact that they're willing to have an opinion. They have to have an opinion that's based in some kind of evidence, some kind of fact-based reporting. There'll be plenty of people in journalism, broadcast, and in podcasts online who will say a lot of things that are patently absurd. But in the journalism that we depend on, we need to have more accountability.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, director of the journalism program at the University of Toronto, former vice president of news and information at NPR, and NPR's first ombudsman from 1997 to 2006. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.